gets stuck in the dead is pretty full. Can you describe from the Regency Sea days and so describe from also from the Regency? Thank you very much for doing that work. Microphone, if you could please do state your name whenever you walk up to the microphone, because the people who are attending remotely don't have the benefit of seeing who you are, and it's much easier for them if you state your name. Some time ago, we circulated the minutes from Rite 57. Hopefully, you have had time to look at them. Are there any comments that need to be included? No, then they become final at this point. This is the agenda we have put together for this session. Is there anyone that would like to see anything added? No? Okay, fantastic. There will be a bit of announcement later. So let's get started. The first speaker on the list is talking to the other speaker in the list, Danny. For a few minutes about some IBGP style and stuff, and hopefully, you know, there are things in this talk actually that are some of it's, you know, as a network operator, things that you can do in your network to change, you know, some of the effects of what I talk about today. Some of it is implementation stuff that probably should be fixed, and other things are protocol, you know, tweaks that should probably be made. So there's kind of a slew of stuff here, and it's a little different perspective than, you know, than hopefully a lot of what you've seen on the BGP front. So anyway, you know, one of the key things about, you know, about some of the data I see is most of the research and studies and, you know, analysis that people do today is based on, you know, DFZ size, and it's based on, you know, any study you see or any you know, sort of academic studies you've seen traditionally, we're focused on, you know, one perspective, an external BGP session. And, you know, it's very different if you look at the dynamics of, you know, sort of, you know, an IBGP in a network and the number of hash reflected and how many routes there were and so forth. So we're going to talk a little more about that today. What works first? All right, so, you know, the big thing, you know, that you hear about from having scalability perspective or even around our scalability perspective is DFZ size and, you know, how many routes are there in the routing system and how many of those end up in a FIP. And, you know, so in a 40 information base, and what's the size of the chips that are doing this and so forth. And, you know, that's, of course, a very important issue, but, you know, there's something else that matters a lot, and it's the number of unique routes, not just the number of prefixes in the routing system that, you know, it's important. And the reason it's important is because, you know, the more unique routes you have, the more state, the more turn, the more FIB IO that's going to be, you know, be affected and so forth. So what we're going to look at here, we're going to talk a lot about, is the number of unique routes in the routing system as opposed to just the number of prefixes in the routing system. So here's an example. Actually, this came from level 3. It's about a decade worth of growth in FIB size, which is more or less FIB size. It's DFZ, unique prefixes, so number of routes that are unique in the routing system, number of prefixes in the routing system. Here's the red line. I think you see this pretty well. And then the green line is the number of paths in level 3's network. Obviously, the number of paths is very dependent upon, you know, sort of your network and routing architecture. But it's also dependent on things like external interconnection density. So the more people around you interconnect, the more paths you're going to have for a given prefix. And so that has, you know, as you can see here, the number of paths is actually growing more steeply than the number of unique prefixes. A bit of a busy slide. I think most of you that do routing or network architects are probably, you know, trying to envision this in some way or another. Here's my attempt to capture it. And basically what you see is with the top, you know, the top left box there is sort of the BGP routing table. And, you know, for each one of your peers, you have what's called an adjacent ribbon, and you have some BGP decision process, and then your loop rib, which is your BGP best routes routing table, and then your adjacent routes for each one of your peers as well. And then those feed into some sort of routing table manager sort of component, something that says, I'm going to prefer a static route or a connected route over a route to BGP, for example. that's what a rally table manager sort of would do. And then from there, you know, you just have your RIM, you say it's my routing information base, and then that RIM is sort of abstract and some hardware address information and next hop stuff's added, and it's distributed to one or more FIBs or forwarding information bases. Some of the typical numbers today, and you know, the DFC size or a typical backbone network is around, you know, maybe 350,000. You know, some have much larger, some may have 500,000. Prefixes in, you know, in sort of your, you know, in your FIB. But one of the things important is the number of unique paths in a routing system, the number of unique routes, as opposed to just the number of unique prefixes. Because, you know, most networks today, most larger networks, is anywhere from, you know, 2 to 6 million paths today in, you know, in those routers. And you know, I was at Quest, gosh, it was 10 years ago now, and we had about 2.5 million paths in some of our core routers, and we changed some stuff on the IBGP, you know, sort of topology network architecture side to minimize some of that. So I'm going to talk about a little bit of that as well. One of the things that's interesting is that any best path change, so if you've got, you know, if you've got 6 million prefixes, I'm sorry, 6 million paths in your BGP table, any change in a best path means that all of this stuff has to change. That red line that you just see there, right? Every one of those things has to change. So the more paths you have, the more churn you have, and, you know, the more fib I/O you're going to have all the way down, you know, through this. And one of the interesting things is that, you know, on the RIB side, you know, the RIB to the FIB, that's usually not even a single transaction. That's usually sort of multi-phase stuff. So, you know, you say, hey, here's a route. Thank you. I acknowledge that and so forth. So, you know, the I/O and the bandwidth and the CPU required to keep this information updated is significant. And so the number of paths has a huge impact on forwarding performance and state and, you know, backplane capacity and all of those sorts of things. So why is the number of unique routes increasing faster than the number of prefixes? You know, one of the biggest things is internal topology, we're going to talk a lot about. And another thing is external interconnection distance. This is where the internet gets flatter, or the US perimeters, as networks become more densely interconnected, the number of available paths is going to grow larger. And so I'll actually illustrate that in this slide. Yeah, good. So you've got, you know, edge ASE here, and they got one prefix, a /24, and they decide that they're going to connect to, you know, to three ISPs, right? So it's not just three paths, you know, three unique routes in a routing system, right? What you actually end up with is, you know, if you know, these ISPs interconnect in 10 places, it's 22 paths at the perimeter of your network at home, you know, just for this one prefix and this one multi-home DS. And so that's sort of how it builds up. Now, this is on the perimeter of your network. So then if you use something like route reflection, for example, and you use three route reflectors, then that multiplies and it comes into the network. And I'm going to talk about that some more in a minute. So one of the things that I hear a lot of folks say is route reflection sort of gets this implicit aggregation function if you use route reflectors. In other words, a route reflector only advertises a single best path to the rest of the IBGP speakers, and that is true. However, most people actually use more than one route reflector in the network. And so if you have, you know, two or three or, you know, your route reflectors sort of mirror your physical topology, then you're gonna have whatever many paths you have, unique paths within a given pop. Each one of those is gonna be multiplied by the number of routes and the number of route reflectors that you have. And so I'll illustrate this in just a minute. Let's see anything else here we're seeing. So what you see here is a real simple topology where, you know, you got a prefix down the bottom, and then you got a cluster, and, you know, the blue routers represent, say, aggregation routers where you might connect customers or data center or something like that, and the gray routers actually represent route reflectors. So, you know, those would be the interconnect routers for backbone links and so forth. And typically, you have some physical topology, and you've got some model for a number of route reflectors that you have in a, you know, in a given pop for, you know, for within a cluster. And so if that bottom left cloud there would be a cluster, for example, and the gray routers would be the route reflectors, and the route reflectors would be IBGP paired with the route reflectors in the other pops. So if you learn one prefix, you know, P/24 in this case, on one of those clients, he would tell his three route reflectors, and those three route reflectors would tell, you know, everyone else. So everybody inside the IBGP mesh would have three copies of that prefix from the three route reflectors just from the one pop. So if you multi-home to another cluster, for example, that same prefix, then that's three more that's going to be in the core. So now you have six. In every one of those four routers, you have six copies of the same prefix because of router reflector topology. So I'll illustrate that some more in just a bit. So one of the other things is get a lot of gratuitous updates with our reflectors. And one of the things that we've been looking at, actually, there's going to be a paper at IMC that I'm working on with some of the UCLA folks. And during the busiest times of, you know, BGP processing, during the top, you know, 0.01% busiest time, 97% of all the updates you receive from average PR are duplicates, exact duplicates. And if you're receiving these duplicates without flat dampening, and any other policy you might have associated with that would apply to each one of those updates. So in a minute, I'll illustrate for you how route reflectors inside of a network or any non-transitive attribute like next stops or cluster lists or BGP next, for example, if any of those change inside your network and it, you know, sort of boils its way out to the perimeter, then you're going to send duplicate updates, you know, outside your network as a result of that. And you don't know why it changes externally, but things like route flat dampening still apply. So to illustrate this for you, you get this prefix and you got a client down here on the bottom, and the advertiser is giving prefix to his three route reflectors. And each of the route reflectors decide that the blue pack is the best, right? So what happens is, you know, when one of these guys go away with the blue route reflector, even though he may not be in the 40 path, then they select a new one, right? Well, that doesn't seem like a big deal, right? It's like, hey, I had some IBGP topology change, not a big deal, right? What actually happens is, in implementations today, is that it results in that edge router on the other side of the network sending three updates, or five updates, or maybe more externally as a result of these attributes that changed inside the network. And so it causes lots of duplicates. So that route could be suppressed at the address point of the network as a result of that. So one of the things I noted here is in a very busy time, so we got a lot of stats on this, but that we're going to publish, and I'm sure they'll be available to all you folks. But 97% of the updates that you receive during the busiest processing times are exact duplicates, and it's for reasons like this. It's some non-transitive BGP attribute, like local pref or next stop or net or cluster list or whatever changes, and as a result of that, you send gratuitous external updates. Okay.
That's right. When you say duplicates, that duplicate paths or duplicate prefixes?
It's an exact copy of the update. From the perspective of the ABGP peer, it's an exact copy of the same update. Because what happens is the attributes that change that generated, the attributes that change that caused, a new BGP path selection to happen were stripped off before you advertise it externally, but the implementation is not smart enough to say, oh, I better not send this because it's an exact duplicate. So there are implementation optimizations that can be found there. And then there are some things from a BGP perspective that, this also happens inside the network. For example, with cluster list changes, if the contents of a cluster list change, then a route reflector might still send a new copy of an update as a result of that. And so it's an efficiency that can be optimized either in an implementation or in a protocol. So at back updates, this is actually one of the things I was talking about earlier, the CDF on the right side there. And during the busy times, if you look at the chart here, all the red is duplicates, and the line you can't see there is the unique update. So it's pretty pathetic from a systemic performance perspective, for a protocol designer. So we didn't do a great job with this in the real routing system. So this is real data from route views and a couple of other places, coupled with information from level 3's IBGP topology to figure out which IBGP attributes changed and trigger external updates. So it's coupling the two together to figure out why we got these duplicate updates. And I like the chart here, but the main reasons, again, were next hop changes, UMD changes, and cluster list changes that result in these sort of instabilities. One of the things that really frustrated me, actually, I experienced this when I was at Quest, we had Cisco core routers, and we had Juniper edge routers, and one of the things I noticed, so I was doing this exercise where I was figuring out how many paths were on each router from each point of the network, and a lot of our routers were seeing extra paths, and I didn't understand why they had all these extra paths, and it turns out that from RSC 1996 to 2796, there was this change. So when BGP was initially designed and route reflection was specified, one of the things that happened is a client on a route reflector didn't have to know it was a client. And the reason it didn't have to know is because it's so that people could deploy route reflection, it would be backwards compatible with route reflector with clients that are BGP speakers that didn't understand route reflection. So if they didn't understand route reflection, they didn't know what an originator ID was or cluster list, things like that. And so they didn't know to poison based on that path vector. And And so, so anyway, one of the changes that was made, or basically the rule was if I'm about to reflect on a client telling me something, I tell all my IBGP peers and I tell all my clients. Well, I can't tell the client that told me. And the reason you couldn't do that was because you would get routing information when that router might install that information. Well, what changed in 2796 is it says, well, let's make an exception here. If a client tells me something now because it's 10 years after route reflection was specified, so if a client tells me something and I'm a route reflector, I can reflect that back to the client and everyone else and expect the client to poison it, and the client should poison it based on the fact that the originator ID equals the router ID, and so they would drop the update, right? So it doesn't seem like a big deal, but why would you want to do that? Well, you know, an implementation optimization was that if I generate that update one time and then copy it across all my peers, then I have to, you know, have one instruction set. And if I don't do that, I do it per peer and have to exclude that client, then I got, you know, the instructions per, you know, per peer, basically. So it's much more difficult from an implementation perspective. The problem is that that doesn't consider things like system at stake. And let me actually illustrate that for you here. So here's the, you know, sort of the high-level topological view of this. Is that you have a prefix, P/24, and you tell the route reflectors. Each of the route reflectors tell their IBGP peers and they tell their clients. But they also tell the route reflector back, right? Just from the design perspective. That doesn't even look efficient, right? Because he's never, ever going to use this information, right? The only reason he should ever receive anything back that he advertises is an implicit withdrawal because the route that he advertised or route reflector was a new best pass, right? So what happens is all these get, you know, get dropped on input. So those route reflectors should really never reflect that information back. One of the problems, though, is it doesn't seem like, you know, it didn't seem like a big deal, but if you think about how this behaves in a real network, you know, so let's take that, you know, sort of just the BGP picture for a minute, right? And what happens is this prefix is advertised. It's, you know, it's processed and makes it to the adjacent about 3 cell pairs. The route reflectors get it, and they all reflect it back, right? But what happens is this is, assume that this router, so all BGP implementations today that are, you know, production, service update processing in a round-robin fashion for each of their peers, right? So what ends up happening is this, is that they advertise the route out to the route reflectors and they advertise it back. So assume he's got 100,000 prefixes from the BGP peer, this client that we're looking at. So he starts getting an update. So he gets, say, 10 updates in. And he starts, you know, round-robin, he starts advertising his update stage to his route reflectors, right? What happens is the route reflectors reflect them back and they get placed in this input processing queue. And the reflected updates that are coming back get ahead of some of the production updates that are coming in from the BGP peer in the first place. Right? And so from a systemic perspective, like, that's a horrible thing, right? Because you got this stuff that you know you're going to discard and you're never going to use, and it's being reflected back to you, and it's being processed before production updates in the data, you know, in the control path anyway. And so, you know, when you look at it from this perspective, it's pretty ugly. What's unfortunate is that you don't see this when you do, you know, a show like, you know, show like BGP or, you know, show route or anything, right? You don't see these updates because they're all being discarded. And, you know, so it's, you know, it's horribly inefficient from, you know, a protocol design perspective. And so it's one of the things that, when you're processing these really busy updates, right, and, you know, a lot of what you're seeing is duplicates anyway, and you can't converge production traffic or bring up a production peer because you're processing this garbage that you just want to throw away, it's, you know, it's really inefficient. So I gave you this picture. So one of the things really interesting is that for 25/47 IPVPNs, you have a lot of people that want to bridge information between VRFs on the same PE routers. And the way they've done this traditionally is to configure a policy on the PE router and say, if I get a route in on this VPN, bridge it and, you know, configure a process, share it with these other, excuse me, gosh, share it with these other VRFs on this router. So one of the things that, you know, that someone wanted to do is they didn't want to have to configure that policy. So what they wanted is they wanted to announce the routes to the route reflector. And because they're being reflected back, say, well, it's being reflected back. If this accept don't do any of these attached to that, accept it and process it anyway, even if the cluster list or the originator ID matches my local router ID. So now we're building upon this behavior. As a, you know, as a result, we're building upon this bad behavior to get around the local configuration issue in the first place. And so if the only thing you reflected back from the route reflectors were prefixes that had this accept don't command, that would be fine. But, you know, what's going to happen is people that implemented route reflection correctly in the first place are going to change the route reflection behavior and reflect everything back. And then only if this accept don't community is is on it, or they know the process normally. So, you know, we're going to force implementations to do even dumber things than they're doing today. So some of the network architectural considerations, cluster IDs. So, you know, I don't know how many people here actually use PowerFlexion, and you know, I've used it in three or four different networks, and I've been involved with a bunch of operators that use it. And one of the things that that I always thought is that most people used cluster IDs, like for a cluster, if you go back to that earlier picture, those three route reflectors in a cluster have the same cluster ID. And you don't have to do that. As a matter of fact, the cluster ID would default to the router ID on the route reflector if you need to configure a cluster ID. And a lot of people just let it default and let the information get exchanged between the routers. One of the problems with this is, sort of that diagram we had earlier. And one of the problems is this, is that these guys are advertising routes they learn from their client down here to IBTP peers back to the client they learn from. But they're also, all these route reflectors are advertising these exact same prefixes to each other, and they're never going to use these. And so they're never going to use these prefixes. And it doesn't seem like a big deal, right? But the thing is that if you look at this, you know, again, from the number of paths or systemic perspective, if I get 100,000 routes from this, you know, from this AS down here, from this external peer, and each one of those are advertised between the route reflectors, that's going to be 200,000 extra adjacent event entries or extra prefixes I'm going to have to carry on each of those route reflectors as a result of that. So that has a really big impact on, you know, on the memory and the utilization and the churn and the instability and all that stuff. And you're never going to use that. So, you know, common cluster IDs are something that, that you should employ. What else? So there's actually lots of other stuff. You know, placements of peers versus customers and, is a big thing. So where you, you know, where you have reachability or what prefixes, like for example, within a cluster, those route reflectors are only going to advertise out a single best route, but it's going to be multiplied by the number of route reflectors. And so things like that matter. One of the best ways to analyze number of paths, certainly configure common cluster IDs, but the number of route reflectors you use per cluster is important. But there are deployment considerations with route reflection where if your route reflectors aren't congruent to the physical topology, or if a client, if a set of route reflectors happen to appear through a client on one of those route reflectors, you can get forwarding information loops or forwarding loops. And so you got to be pretty particular with that. Let's see. One of the other things is that those 2 to 6 million paths you're seeing today, if you guys go look at one of your core routers probably have a lot more paths on them than even your edge routers. And then when you start adding things like other address families, like, you know, IP6 or, you know, or IPVPNs or using FlowSpec or L2VPN with, you know, with BGP stuff or multicast VPNs, all these things are employing the control, you know, the same control plane. And so if you, you know, all these updates that are being reflected back and outputting, you know, in front of that, you know, in front of those, you know, those other network services as well. So this is something else to keep in mind. Another big thing is I see lots of people propose all the time new communities or you know, some new attribute like an IGP, advanced IGP metrics or whatever, and each new community that you transit, like for example, one of the things that I always did is I would rewrite any MID I received on ingress to an explicit value because I didn't use MID because MIDs are broken most of the time anyway. And strip all the communities and rewrite the communities. And if you don't do that in your network, then what's going to happen is you're going to have more unique paths, right? And so if you look at attribute growth, and this is actually a level 3 network over the last 10 years, and you know, every time you have a new attribute means that you can't do things like BGP update packing. So you have to send a unique update for every single prefix you have, and you can't pack them because they all have unique attribute sets. And so all these sorts of things have scalability implications on, you know, on the routing system. Routing security. So one of the other things is that if you're employing any kind of routing security, then each feasible path, in other words, each thing that makes this redundant adjacent event would have to be validated, you know, in some manner. And so can I accept this route from this peer? The other thing is that each path also means that you know, that if you're gonna use something like ECP 38 or URPF with path for, you know, for anti-spoofing, for example, then each one of those 2 to 6 million paths has to be a feasible path in some process. Policy has to be applied to that in a forwarding path now, right? And so the more paths you have, the more, you know, the more scalability consideration you're going to have from there. Additionally, one of the irons in all this is, you know, there's certainly protocol changes that can be made for some of this stuff, but most of the work that's going on in IDR right now, which is where BGP specified in the NTF, is actually associated with or aimed at adding more paths or adding new attributes. Nothing is, you know, really being done to minimize the number of existing attributes. something to keep in mind is, you know, these are huge scalability considerations, and a lot of the stuff floating around the network is not benign. It's, you know, it's being processed in front of your production updates. What else matters here? So, you know, the number of unique prefixes in the routing system, you know, what your fib size is going to be, and that's fine, but the number of paths means you're going to have X more fib I/O and everything up the stack you saw on that first diagram I put up. And it's certainly something that you need to consider, you know, in the network design and, you know, architecture side of the house. Let's see. That's pretty much it, actually. We're publishing a couple of different papers around some of this to qualify and quantify neural networks. And, you know, one of them is going to be an IFC that Lisa Jang and our team at UCLA has worked on with Shane Amonte from Level 3 and myself. lots of folks reviewed some of the earlier stuff I did with this. And on this, you know, there are BGP optimizations or implementations that should do different things. And there are ways you can architect a network to minimize the number of paths or, you know, or expand it depending on whatever it is you want to accomplish. So, that's it. Any questions? I know I went pretty quickly through this, but there are actually a bunch more slides that talk about MRAI and a bunch of other things in the slide deck that's posted online. So, great question.
Great stuff, first of all, Benny. Thanks. You mentioned there at the end, the patch base being added to BGP, and we already have implementation issues or protocol design issues that are affecting the scalability and really functional stability of the internet at large. Going way back, when NBGP was first proposed, everyone was concerned about operational stability of the BGP code, and they didn't want it in the path, and so we kind of bolted onto the side. Same discussion came around with MSDP, we don't want to destabilize BGP, leave it alone. That institutional memory seems to have been lost. And everyone wants to throw stuff on BGP, and here you've got great data showing, wait a minute, we need to step back and talk about stabilizing what we have and improving it. Why isn't that dialogue taking place in the ATF?
So it definitely needs to, and when you look at like RRG and some of the new stuff that's happening, you know, this you know, again, that's when I started working on this, is to try and inform some of that, because there are a lot of implications, like, you know, the implosion inside of networks instead of just the DFC size. The other thing that I don't mean to marginalize anyway is that, like, you know, all the new address families, I'm not against some of that stuff, because if it's not in BGP, it's got to be done somewhere, and you're going to run another parallel protocol and state machine code to the same and so forth. So it's, you know, it's sort of a balancing act. It's just, you know, this is something that people need to give more consideration to, because it does have a huge impact on, you know, on scalability of systems. So, yeah, question.
Can you give some description on what specific implementations you've been observing this kind of behavior in terms of reflection, as an example?
So with GNOS, iOS, and certain versions, and there are some improvements, and we've worked with folks like Keyork, Patel at Cisco, who is looking to optimize some of this, in particular with the duplicates, because there are some really smart things you can do to minimize 95% of those. And the implementation, and it's not a lot of work. You just have to add, you know, another index there and keep track of a couple of things. And so with production versions of both GNOS and iOS, we've seen these, and I do have version numbers if you want to see them, and so forth. So if anybody wants any more information, I'm happy to hook you up with that. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
I'm not testing myself. I'm asking whether there are any more questions for
Benny.
If not, then thank you very much. Thank you very much for the presentation.
Some warnings there. Perfect. Jack, the brief caffeinated, which kind of makes things easier for me to get through a lot of material, and I had nickel cappuccino before this, so we're all in trouble. But, you know, shout out, call me names, whatever you need, jump on the mic. This really is looking at, I guess what it is, what we expected versus where we are, and some objectives that I still have in trying to scale the rest of the world coming together. I wouldn't necessarily say I've got answers. Lots of questions, a lot of projections on where I think the problem space is and maybe what some of the solution space is targeting. So
Well, IPT is taking off. I've been banging off multicast and video over IP for 10-plus years, and it was kind of exciting about 5 years ago when it suddenly became operational requirements. They pissed off with these old guys in the closet, and now we've got real work to do. So that was exciting to see it get ramped up. But really what happened is it flew in the face of what the initial expectations were when the multicast protocols and solutions were first being rolled out, you know, back, gosh, late 80s, early 90s. And at that time, the expectation was this global connectivity, because that's what the internet was. Right? We didn't have firewalls, we didn't have NATs, we had end-to-end connectivity and services, and multicast was rolled over right along with that. And the expectation was we had this global video broadcast network. And that never happened. And really what we have is these walled garden-based providers rolling out IPTV services where they want to maintain control of their customer base by providing or being the provider of all services to them. And there's very little back-end connectivity. So what we have then is the content has become very regional in the same way that the traditional TV networks are very regional, which is completely opposite of all the other data we get on the internet. And right now, when I open Google News, I get news links around the world, and I can read world perspectives on U.S. events and not be forced to look at, you know, the local content. But the video space is still frozen that way. And so with the IPTV edge rollouts is kind of preserving that. And a lot of it has to do with, in the U.S. specifically, long-term contracts with affiliates and, you know, this idea that they draw a circle on a map around their antenna and they own this population of people. And those contracts are starting to age out. They're starting to decay a little bit, and the technology is getting in place. They're getting different relationships, different levers to open that up. So, but because of the content owner, you know, gosh, cost, ownership, distribution, all these relationships are controlling the competition in this space, is preventing this opportunity to do things over the top. Again, as these contracts are starting to fade, the question really is, will that last? And if not, as it erodes, are there opportunities for new services to wedge in there and change the market? Now, this was taken from a customer graph that was given in a presentation I had some years ago. They said I couldn't use the data, so I recreated the relationships without real values, just to give you, because really what we're talking about is relationships here. So on the x-axis there, we've got time. Y-axis would be bit rate. So take any arbitrary unit of time, days, months, years, decades, doesn't really matter. We've got three basic types of traffic coming into your home. This is an edge network and the receiver side. And you can see, you know, VoIP's increasing a little bit, but there's never going to be a significant amount of traffic in your VoIP communication. So if everyone on the home was on the phone, different calls, it wouldn't be a significant part of the data. Video ramps up fairly quickly, but aside from the what we call the USD outliers, and like DirecTV has got an NFL premium packet where you can get literally a wall full of tuners and every TV on the walls tuned to a different football show, this is in US point of ball. That's an outlier stream. The average home, 2-3 max HD streams, is really going to ramp up and kind of cap at some point where even with VOD and queuing into your TiVo Live or Drive device, it's not going to be, it's bounded, let's say, right? It ramps up and eventually starts tapering off. But what's happening at the edge of the competition amongst the edge providers is around access to bandwidth itself. And so the money's being thrown into providing bigger and bigger access paths to compete against the other edge networks. And what they're doing is creating this opportunity for other services outside of what they think is controlling their current customer base. So right now, for IPTV service is a really value-added service and it's functioning for them today. But really, if you look at it, it's no different than what they got from the traditional cable space or even the rabbit ears back when it was all analog. The content hasn't changed much. It's still very regionally centric. And with the access network growing, effectively unbounded, it's opened up the opportunities for over-the-top video solutions. And though we don't see any market like real leader right now, we do see the cracks in the shell. We see the Move Network selling the service out, but not, you don't see their name up front like you do with Juice or YouTube. But they're back there providing this over-the-top video services. We've got, just, you know, BitTorrent, of course, has been happening for a long time. And then some work happening that I'll talk about a little bit here is AMT, which is potentially an opportunity to bridge those networks where they have multicast backends and try to get out to the edge networks that aren't connected. So now as the bandwidth goes up, it makes these services even more functional, right? So as they become more functional, they start challenging the traditional IPTV viewing that we currently have. And of course, there's going to be some hardware issues there too. Sitting in front of your TV is not the same as sitting in front of your computer, but I don't know what you're like at home. I've got a Mac Mini 6, my TV, and there's really no difference anymore. And so we sit around the television to watch content that's over IP. And of course, the DVRs are changing this too, and I've got this thrown back at me from Europe. Oh, we don't have TiVo over here yet. The solution is still you informed you from some other service. Now, the truth is, you don't care how that got there. It could have been across a cable provider. It could have been across a BitTorrent client of some kind, right? I now use my parents as the litmus test. You know, their VCR still flashes 12, right? They don't even set the clock on the box. So if the technology requires them to get off their butts and change something, it's not going to happen. It has to be plug and play. And so for them, they don't care how that data got there. You know, it's funny in the multicast world, people say, I want a directory of multicast content. That's okay for the geeks that are playing with the technology. You guys who want the content don't give a rat's backside what the transport is. They just want to get the bits there. So, now this is all great for non-live content, right? It makes a lot of sense. And even for some live events, like, for example, I'm not a big playing golf fan, but I do watch the Super Bowl and playoffs when it happens. I don't watch it live. I can't stand the commercial crap that everyone's excited about. My halftime show just bores us to stop. I mean, so I'll be more than happy to work in my shop and chew it up, and then come back later and fast forward through the commercials. But in a lot of markets, live TV is still going to be very critical. The one thing that came up during the World Cup event in Germany a few years back, when the IPTV rules were fairly new at the time, there was a German website that was showing all the different IPTV providers and comparing them by latency. Because what they didn't want was to have all the friends over to watch the match and hear their neighbor scream goal when they were watching the ball across midfield. So suddenly, live TV is a real issue in some markets, and we don't have the solid technology to address that at a global scale yet. So what is the end game? Okay, I'd like to go back to this idea of ubiquitous broadcast global network. The same idea that if I want to get a handful of different channels around the planet, I shouldn't have to be graced by my local provider to tell me I can or can't get the content. You know, like this, if I can watch or read New Zealand Times of Auckland right there on a web page and not have to get authorization from my local newspaper to say I can get that news. So why do we have that same controlling factor in video? It shouldn't be the case. So now, the trouble is we have these multicast connected networks at the edges working really well, but very little global multicast pairing. In fact, the global static prefix count is still between 6 and 10 gig prefixes. Now, compared to what Danny was showing in the hundreds of thousands, you can see we don't have that kind of connectivity to really make that critical mass go forward. But multicast is known as a proven solution. We have business models built around edge networks right now that is dependent upon multicast. We just need this global live content to make it happen. Otherwise, we're all forced to use unicast, and then the whole scaling model falls apart, especially for the content owner. But you're used to injecting that now into this multicast infrastructure to get to the local affiliates. If you want to get that globally, you're forced to go to a one-to-one stream again. So the problem is, I can blast with some of the stats. This is, again, much so much, and more into my man bear pig. But, the multicast is this all-or-nothing problem. Everybody has to turn it on. You can't get there. And we've seen lots of failed business models in the past going way back to broadcast.com that had the idea of, this global connectivity but didn't have the control. If you give me enable and all your routers, we can make it happen. It's just, I doubt that's going to happen today. So there's too many people in the food chain to motivate that process to get people on the content, people they're buying transit services from, which you could possibly be tier ones at the core. You've got edge networks and various layers of them, as well as vendors making the products edge that may not support the stuff. And trying to get all that coming together just has been insurmountable to get this happening on a global scale. So even these multicast aware content providers of the past are forced to use unicast. So is there really a future for the streaming for live? And this is my little pitch. AMT is something I see as an opportunity to really bridge that gap. I can bore you with a little bit of history. Yeah, I'm going to do that. If you go way back to the early days of multicast, DDMRP was Deering's initial, his thesis. And it was the idea of making basically a broadcast domain on top of the first layer 3 infrastructure there at Stanford. And in order to do that, he knew he didn't have this feature enabled on the boxes, so DDMRP included the tree building for multicast distribution, RPF checking with prefix advertisement, and it also had tunneling. And the best I can check, and if someone can dig back deeper and prove me wrong, I'd love it, but the first instance of encapsulation for tunneling I found in any RFC was DDMRP back in 1889. And it's funny because as multicast progressed and we moved into the protocol independent multicast and we're using the local RIB for RPF checking, we threw out encapsulation and tunneling. But we assumed everyone would go native. Well, it didn't happen. So now we're forced to go back and think about what did we do wrong? What pieces did we potentially not deliver? And what I'm proposing is that IGMP should have been multi-hop from the beginning. If we had a PIM domain that we knew was distributing the trees and we couldn't get that radius out wide enough to the jurisdictions to increase the radius of deployment. So as a provider, the interest we've seen so far, to step back a little bit, is in cases where the content owner and provider are the same entities, so you have to try to put these people together. You've got edge devices in some parts of the network that don't replicate well, and they want an AMT as a way to get over that. They also have content they want to get to a global audience, and so they're looking to run an AMT relay services both at their edge networks where they have legacy equipment and at their peering locations where they don't want to get this out, and it looks like they need to pass to the rest of the world, but within their own infrastructure, they're made at the core, and they're the content owners well for injection. They have all the efficiency and the properties of multicast without having to re-inject all this content from the global audience or to get over the limitations of the legacy equipment at the edge. And again, they continue to push that out. In some cases, they're looking at placing this right next to like a B-SLAM, something or a B-RAS box. What we've currently done, we've got a test implementation at NXOS. Like, you guys know it engineers there. The reason it is in NXOS is because Dino's there, and Dino's a multicast guy, and I've been working with Dino for a long time. So we wrapped this code up from some early work with Dino Procket. Now it's in NXOS, and we have it in a what are you, just a test box, a PC interact that we use for deployment testing currently. UT Dallas has written a public implementation of both Gateway and Relay that runs on Linux, and on the Gateway site alone, they've got support for the Mac, Windows. I think they've got a Linux implementation also. And more recently, I'm working with an engineer who's developing the Gateway services on the Google phone for Android, and have some content owners excited about injecting 3GPP content across their current multicast infrastructure and still get it via unicast over AMT to the Android handsets. So we've got provider testing taking place, as I alluded to with that diagram. There's a box at Lynx right now with Global Mix, and they're doing some local content, and he's also advertising the global NCAST prefix. So content that I've got in Palo Alto can make it across the multicast infrastructure to his site and get his receivers as well. That's been the packed box is part of IFC.org's network. I work for Cisco, but I got a bunch of hats. I've been banging around with ISD for a long time. They're kind of the line of misfit toys, and I'm fairly misfit, so it worked out all right. And NetDoc's got a box, and if actually he's not here, I was going to give him heat. It just went down some time ago. I'm trying to get him to get stuff backed up, but he's got some multicast boxes in the path that he's having issues with. And we're always looking for more participation. Right now, again, the test is taking place primarily with this one vendor because one customer because they've got a service they want to roll out within the next 12 to 18 months, and then the Android stuff is taking a lot of time as well. But once Android code is available, I think it's going to be open source for everyone to play with. Now, reality is we step back and now talk about best effort. Well, because I'm talking about this broadcast infrastructure and multicast in particular, it is UDP, right? So what we get is a fire forget. You don't have, once it leaves your admin control, you don't have any feedback, really, of how successful it was in receiving the eyeballs. Now, in the aggregate deployments at the edge, they own the network command. They set up, a 4-2 policy and say, separate their elastic from elastic traffic to ensure that content gets there. But if you're doing this really across the global internet, how do you know it's going to get there? Is the quality of the internet really ready for this global distribution? So this comes from Colin Perkins. I did hack out a couple of the slides, and I was going to try to cut this down, but I left at least most of the key features in there, so even if I don't talk to them directly, you'll have them to review on your own and harass Colin directly. But he's looking at doing this, and he began this initially of just UDP video-like and VoIP-like distribution across the internet at large with a receiver device or code that tests just loss and jitter. The hope would be then to look at standard loss characteristics, and if you can quantify them in some way, then you know what you can do to your flows to protect them, whether it's a lightweight FEC or something more complicated or sophisticated, which I'll allude to a little bit later on. So it's basically a global infrastructure like this. He's got two different edge networks, the first case he came from, cable and DSL, and then it's crossing multiple infrastructures. So let's see. For just UDP, and he's got there's this box, and there's his flows. Okay, so he's got CDR flows, three of them, 1, 2, and 4 megabits. So basically, this is just a standard definition. And he gets some point stuff as well in CDR 64K. Now, one of these is not there. The 4, there we go. The cable modem. In this cable network where you have the receiver, you have the capability of receiving 4 megs, so that gig is not there, unfortunately. But Linux code, or looking for more people to participate, when you can download his Linux code and run it on the box in your own network, or just put one of these embedded boxes in place. And unfortunately, again, you know, just the nature of the pace, he's doing bursts, you know, 10-minute bursts. And if you look at what's happening in live DVD and even the IPTV forms of various flavors, trying to quantify acceptable errors. You know, we look at it as network operators in terms of time. And time is not relative to a viewer's experience. You know, a viewer doesn't say, hey, I lost, I had a 10-millisecond gap here. But they won't even talk in terms of percentage, I had 10% loss. What they want to know is, did you turn the channel because the viewing experience was so crappy, or did they stay right there? So what they're trying to quantify, this is more like MTBF. And what they're looking at is how many visible artifacts per viewing element of time. And that wasn't 2 hours. They broke it down to 1 hour now, I guess, for some sort of unity. So artifacts per hour is the metric they're trying to look at. So if we're doing like 10-minute bursts, it's kind of hard to gather that, and you can extrapolate that in some way. But if you're talking about real random distribution, not only of loss, but of loss patterns, and you've got a very low probability of a particular loss pattern, you're not going to find it within an hour interval if you're sampling at 10 minutes. But there's some data from this to extrapolate from there, at least. So look at that over time. Red being ADSL and green being cable space. These were for the one-man streams. It looks like the ADSL a little bit worse, but the cable spike worse. But the reality is packet loss percentages are still very, very low. When you're talking about percentages down, you know, below 8% like that, a little red FEC can handle it. Even POP3 can handle that for random distribution. But we need to look deeper inside what the loss patterns are to really make that determination. So this is packet loss duration and frequency. And I've asked him to turn this around as an MTBF. I've got a slide that looks at that a little bit. We'll try to make sense of this. So this is correlated loss by number of packets. So a truly random distribution would be single loss packets distributed evenly. But an IP network, that's not necessarily the case. If you lose a packet, you're highly likely to lose an adjacent packet as well because the events overlap. It's not packet-based, it's time-based. And you're going to cut packets in half, so your correlation is a little bit higher. So you can see, you know, ones were pretty high, twos are still up there, and as they went down, longer bursts tended to fade off. Still getting bursts as long as nine packets in a row. And that's in the 4-meg space. And I'm going to do this quick in my head. 3 milliseconds per packet, 9. So we're looking at under 30 milliseconds of loss right there at 9. Now, if you look at the DVD analysis of COP3 versus Raptor, I think it was roughly at the 8-millisecond boundary where POPs are to fall apart, which seems awfully small. I mean, I think 10, well, I'll go by their data. They say, if that's the case, we're looking at nearly 30 milliseconds of loss distributed randomly across 10-minute intervals, and we're still getting them, at least enough that one occurred. And if one occurs every 10 minutes, and it's a loss that you can't compensate with COP3, and that's happens every hour, that means 6 impairments per hour that you can't repair with COP3. So it's actually worse than what Colin is extrapolating here, and I need to feedback with him a little bit on this. But here's just a great neat picture. It shows you that really most of the packets come without interruption, right? But most of the interruptions are very short, right, the good runs. So you may have this long burst where nothing happened, but most of the time it's being chopped up quite a bit. Reordering rarely happened at all. This was just, again, detect dispersion. Dispersion really kind of tended to focus around areas of congestion. So during peak times, dispersion was up. During quiescent times, the dispersion was down. Geek slide, of course, this is over time of day. So you can see that early in the morning, there was very little dispersion. But by the evening, when everyone's sitting online doing whatever, dispersion goes way up. And this is something like over 24-hour periods. So you can see this repeating day after day. And in cable space, it was actually extreme in both cases, where even less dispersion during low use and even more dispersion during high use. And part of it is objective. I mean, I got my own objectives from his work, and that's to understand what we needed to do to the transport itself to protect the content. He's also looking at some ways to look at topography for the network itself and learn from that from an operator's perspective. So, you know, this may be more interesting. You can see, again, less dispersion early on, more dispersion later in the day. And repeated as well in 24-hour cycles, such as daily rate. 10 minutes, oh my word. All right, this is the one I wanted to get to, and he gave us systemic. So this is looking more like MDBF. And if we look, right, this is kind of a really tough RPA. The 8 burst packet, which was, you know, 20 milliseconds roughly, is a triangle.
And if I can find that right here, at 4:11 occurred 10 seconds between events.
So, you know, it's not happening all the time, but when it does happen, it's enough that you're going to exceed that impairment per 1 hour interval, and unless we do some either high value FVC, which is not free, or look at better two-dimensional matrices for just Reed Solomon, we're not going to be able to compensate for this 20 milliseconds. So in summary, you know, he's saying the lightweights can do it. It's most cases for random distribution can, but remember, in IP networks, it's not random. Truly random would be single packet losses, but in IP networks, if you lose a packet, you're more likely to lose adjacent packets, so it's not truly random distribution. And then, of course, instead of B2B, you guys are looking at RIN as a real issue, where you've got things like, you know, AC ducts turn on or you go past power systems, and when these periodic events take place, it takes a big chunk of time out of it. Now, we even talked about operational issues. You know, Dan talked about JIRC, and that's loss of connectivity. And we're doing a lot of testing in multicast convergence times themselves and IP convergence times, and we know that this can be tens of milliseconds or hundreds of milliseconds, in extreme cases, multiple seconds before you've got a new route to the secondary path. All right, so, okay, most loss is random to a point. We know that there's large correlated losses. We didn't see a large operational-like losses in this test because, you know, the 10-second or 10-minute, excuse me, test intervals, I don't think there is an updating up window, but even within those 10-second intervals, we saw enough RIN loss, at least for me, to know that COP may not be enough or it'd be difficult to turn COP efficiently around that and still compensate for the RIN loss. So, again, this is an old slide where you need MPDF data, and we have a little bit of that right now. And the library MPC is like, was implemented in COP, or even Reed Solomon can do most of it. But how do we correct for the large losses? So, some of this is not happening on the video side. It was fun when I'm at Cisco, you probably can tell. I've actually been around the block a little bit. I was at Cisco some years ago with early multicast development, and then I took about a 6-year competitive analysis sabbatical. And now I'm back at Cisco again. I was excited to come back when they acquired Scientific Atlantic. Now we have video guys who knew very little about IP. IP guys knew very little about video. And now we're on the same team. So I've learned a lot from these guys. And maybe they learned a little bit from me. But we're seeing in the video space, they're trying to compensate for what they're learning about the IP networks. And one is the solution is MVC. So with multi-decryption coding, they're really still focused around this idea that you control the network. They're breaking the encoding of video up into various layers and then expecting it to be routed in various locations around the network. So if you have one loss in one segment, you can't lose all the data. You've got another path for the other segment to came through. We're seeing that the operators find live like networks as well. And it all seems to be targeted really at better error concealment. So if I lost a fraction of the data, I can recreate that at least from what I do have. It's in the same way that MPEG works on a temporal scale. They're doing this on a spatial scale. But they're not exploiting the temporal domain directly, right? This is MPC, it's just spatial. So I'm thinking of ways to exploit both temporal and spatial on the encoding side without expectation that the network's going to provide you for path diversity or live-like feeds. So let me go just one step before that is SVC is looking at multiple bitrate receivers. Again, if I've got an edge network and I know my set-top box is going to have a certain level of bandwidth, I can encode for that receiver bandwidth I've set. But if I'm trying to get to a global audience, I don't know what the receiver population is going to be like in terms of its receiver distribution. I can have handsets, I can have set-top boxes, I can have PCs on campuses with lots of bandwidth, I can have guys still stuck out in the country like me behind a very small host. So SVC is an attempt to provide a layering mechanism so that you can adapt dynamically to the receiver's bitrate. The trouble is, it actually, I believe, makes the content and the encoding more fragile. What we have is a base layer and enhancement layers. And the base layer now is the base, like an iframe and MPEG-2. Without the base layer, your enhancement layers are worthless. So if you've lost the base layer, right, it's gone. Base layer is your minimum receiver bandwidth. And ultimately, it's not as efficient as you would need. It seems to be in the current encoding, they'll do it in blocks, like 2 to 3 blocks of bitrate ranges. So to try to put all this together, what we've envisioned working by the scientific Atlanta folks and Cisco is multi-lattice video encoding, which takes into consideration temporal redundancy, spatial redundancy, and layering across both dimensions without having to depend upon multiple paths or path diversity of any kind, and without setting precedence on layers. If you truly lay this out with multi-lattice encoding, there's no base layer dependency. Each layer is independently encodable. And because you're transferring this spatial relationship into a temporal domain, you really transform any unrecoverable short-duration error, you shorten, you know, 10, 50, 500 milliseconds, and you can turn that into a recoverable, concealable long-term error. And if you encode it cleverly, take into consideration what MPEG already knows, you can ensure that the artifacts are concealable. There are certain things that human eye detects, and certain things the human eye completely masks. So we've seen the blind spot eye test and such, right, where you don't see anything, but you do, your eye feels it, and your brain's doing this. Well, there's lots of things to do in error concealment that take that into consideration. I mean, the hard, obvious things are vertical and horizontal lines. The human eye picks up on those right away, whereas diagonals, you don't. So if you can consider that the lattice layout in your encoding, you can ensure that when you've got even 25 to 50% loss, the loss occurs in patterns that are easily concealable and undetectable by the human eye. So we've seen practical concealments of 500 milliseconds or more without altering the viewer's experience. And this is either a sort of latency or disruptive artifacts of any kind. And what we've really, wasn't the initial intention, but we've deduced lots of other benefits from this as well, like fast panel change, you know, startup latency reduction, ensuring that you actually look at the order of the frames between the lattices and within a dot to make the transport itself even more resilient. So you separate time dots by even larger gaps when you've got big block losses of any kind. You reduce the percentage of fidelity that is lost by any single event. So now, with all the excitement here instead. So if you think back to the IETF, right, we've done tons of work for robust transport protocols. We've done RTP, RTCP, RTP primarily for the UDP space, with even RTSP feedback. And this is great. But what we found is worked with a couple of startups that were playing with this, you know, video solution 10 plus years ago. They got all excited, had a tool they went to roll out. They take it to the customer's corporate office to display it to the VP of you know, parking, whoever he was, and they couldn't get it because the firewall was blocking everything but port 80 from these certain services. So what they found is even these robust protocols we spent all this work on that working well on the edge networks aren't going to work across the global internet at large because we've got this policy in place, the firewalls is blocking everything but port 80 for much of this stuff. So what's happening is all these different solutions are starting to adopt HTTP. And it's like, again, more and more overhead being placed on it. The trouble is, you know, security is an open window. Just because you open that port doesn't mean only good things are going to come through that port. And the fact is, we're just making clever ways to jump through that hoop to compensate for what you think has been protecting your network all along. So, goodbye, Internet. Welcome to the Port 80 network. So the future challenge, again, what's the end game? I really think there's going to be a global aggregation of content. It just has to happen. We have a global market now. We have an audience that's growing up to expect that global receiver reception of content. And I don't expect this canned cable package stuff to last much longer. Now, that being said, I'm surprised it lasted as long as it did. But we had stumbling blocks along the way. We, you know, technology issues. We had the bubble burst issues. And we didn't have the uptake in the early video like I expected. And now it's already happening. And what's happening with the content owners now is more and more they're injecting the IP and not expecting the satellite bus to get the content there. So with that investment in place, there's an opportunity now to take advantage of that for this global content aggregation. So pretend this IPTV provider didn't actually stay in the food chain anymore, right? If that's their value-added service to sell to their customers, how are they going to stay in the food chain if the over-the-top is going to take that market away? Yeah, that all answers, right? I'm just kind of shaking the business. So we also, the content owners, we're trying to maintain brand identity. If you go to, like, you know, you license YouTube to inject your content, everything looks like YouTube. Well, if I'm Disney, I don't want that, right? I want everyone to come to Disney and know that I'm the one selling your kids' snacks and not YouTube. So, that's for all you South Park fans out there. You know, people like Move, who do this on the back end, don't have their identity in front. That stuff's starting to work. And again, these contracts are based on who owns it and what they're expecting. to erode these old contracts and allow them to get straight to you, the consumer, and not have to go through a middleman. You know, Tier 1 still have a play, as they do, in providing the connectivity, but in terms of the end-to-end, not so much. Will AMT make a difference? Possibly, if we can get through the HTTP problem. And will these firewall supports all in HTTP? Yeah, I think it's already happening. And we're seeing it really, it's kind of like, you brought up something, Dave, it's really good because it keeps coming back. This is like the firewalls we put in to provide a service, and then we find out it's breaking the stuff. So then you start doing bad behavior to get through the broken stuff. Now this bad behavior becomes an operational model, and now all of your standards have to adopt this bad behavior and move forward with it. Dan, you mentioned it as well somewhere in BGP, I forgot the reference, but I keep seeing this coming back over and over again. And so it's kind of happening with HTTP transport as well. It's not just in the firewalls. We also have cache services being laid out there that work for HTTP. So if you've got a video service that's streaming using HTTP, you can just land up the cache and you're there. So it's kind of like a self-reinforcing model. But if the cache services start using a more robust transport at the core, then they're not forced to do that, and they can actually use an efficient mechanism via multicast to preload the cache and then get through those firewalls and HTTP down the edge. All right. Questions?
Hi. Interested. I'm curious, do you, or has anyone written an unreliable sequence packet implementation that uses TCP port 80. You could do it by using the TCP sequence number as a packet sequence number, and all you need to do is ignore the acts from the other side and somehow get the stack to refuse them. Because if you do that, then the firewall in the middle of the block queue has to essentially recreate the same machine on all the nodes behind it. And that sounds like it's very expensive. So, as you said, as long as port is the window is open, maybe you can try to go for it.
Even if the truck is loaded, right?
So I was curious if you'd look into that, or if...
It's interesting. In the back of my head, I haven't looked at the PCP enough to really back through, but it's good to articulate it a little bit here. So you're saying that on the transmit side, don't retransmit.
Yeah.
Just drop those packets and what would the receive stack do?
Well, if the stack is behaving, then it will send you, the kernel will basically reset your TCP sessions. You'll drop the reset packets, and if your application has a raw socket, it will receive the data.
Interesting.
That'll require a raw socket, which means root access on Linux systems. I don't know what you need on Windows style.
Yeah.
But it's not impossible, right?
Sure. It goes back to, let's make bad behavior to overcome other bad behavior.
Oh, yeah, sorry. It's horrible.
It's horrible.
The problem is it will help you so much because the even middle boxes will only permit HTTP sequence number, the app reset, and so on.
That's very expensive to implement. I expect that to be very expensive.
So if we are going to invent new TCP behaviors and fix all the middle boxes in the way, we might actually fix the middle boxes for good.
And
fiddle with the TCP stacks.
Good luck. So the middle box means like cache server or the firewall itself who is actually looking at the TCP
specifically the firewalls, because your typical end user stateful firewall thingy is looking at TCP state.
Yeah.
So if a TCP reset comes along, no matter what the endpoints do, the chances that the firewall will just drop the stuff is very high. If you are going out to work around broken firewalls by fixing broken firewalls and breaking TCP, you have as well fixed the firewall, which is as possible as getting a TCP change and fixed the firewall.
Well, if you're trying to work around a guy
who thinks that only HTTP is allowed.
Well, that's just part of work.
It might also not look at sequence. It might not maintain sequence numbers for all the connections that are going through it, because that might be expensive. That's just an idea.
Thank you. Thank you.
motivation for developing this tool is that most tenants in the building two were already seeing the network as a bunch of nodes that are connected to other links without considering the interconnection with neighbor ASS. But with that kind of problem, you are not able to answer questions such as these one, where internet routing and internet traffic are to be taken into account. So, for example, what will be the impact of geo-denying failure on my traffic? Or what if I change the DB routing policy on my routing and on my traffic? How can I compare various providers regarding DB routing, regarding how my traffic will flow through my peering links? So to answer these kind of questions, you have to build a much more complex model where you take into account the interconnection with neighbor ASs. So for example, if you have to take into account peering links, traffic that is not just between your nodes that's going to external destinations, and there is a lot of prefixes in BGP routing tables. You have to take into account the configuration of the IBGP. So if you have full mesh, if you have router vectors, if you have hierarchy of router vectors, so that's quite complex. So that's why we developed CBGP, a tool that takes the configuration of your network and is able to compute the routes BGP would have computed. So the agenda of my talk is as follows. I first give you some introduction to the CBGP tool, which is really the routing solver. Then another tool, SpinNet, which is used to build a model of an IP network based on data collected in the real network. So SpinNet is going to build a CBGP model for a real network. And briefly give an example of CBGP application. So CBGP is basically two things: network topology and configuration database. So you'll put all your IP equipment configurations there, how they are interconnected. You'll put the configuration of your BGP policies of your BGP neighbors and so on. And you also can inject real BGP routes into the model. Based on that, CBGP will compute the routes that each router in the model would have computed. And so the output of this computation is what we call a routing state. So it's basically the content of the routing tables on all the routers in the model. As an additional step, you can, based on the routing state, forward traffic. So, for example, forward traffic collected with NetFlow on all the routes you've computed, and then compute the load of each link in the model. We have, of course, a limitation in our granularity of our network representation, so we only focus on layer 3 interconnectivity. So we don't see Ethernet and so on. We can, of course, add static routes, some notion of IP tunneling, and we tried this model with quite harsh topologies. Here is an example of how you could script a very simple network with CBGP. So first step, you have to describe the topology. So here, it is very simple. Then configure some IGP stuff, IGP weights. Add some BGP router, configure full mesh. Inject a BGP network. So if here, one network to 255/8 would be announced from router 1.0.0.0. Then run the simulation. And from that, you can start mining the routing state. And for example, trace the route from one router to one given destination and the tool would output either the content of routing tables or the different hubs of your path. So that's basically what the tool does. So we have two route computation models in CBGP. One which is which computes the IBP route, so basically shortest path trees in each autonomous system. And then we have a more dynamic BGP model where we compute the steady state, we'll compute the routing states of BGP once BGP has converged. And we support the full BGP signal process. We support most of the BGP attributes. We also support route reflectors, of course. And we can inject real routing tables in MRT format into the tool, thanks to, for example, BGBLM, which is maintained by RIPE. So, what you can do with this, once you have computed a default routing state based on the configuration of your network, you can start playing with the model and, for example, failing links or changing policies and compute different routing states, which are given the result of these changes in your network. And the goal is to compare these states together to see what happens if I change that stuff in my network. So now, building a CBGP model of a more complex network is a difficult task. You have to introduce a lot of parameters. So we have built a side tool which is based on a lot of parsers, and we can introduce real network data and build the CBGP model based on this. For example, we can parse the output of comments you can run on your favorite equipment, such as, for example, get the dump of the USPF link state database. From that, we can build the topology, get information in the BGP networks. We can parse that and build the CBGP model automatically. Based on that, this tool can also help you visualize your network. So here is the view of the Xiao network, which dates from, let's say, March 2007. You can, of course, also talk to the routing developer through some scripting stuff. And, for example, trace route between two of the nodes or other comments. Here, I'll show two very simple one scenario. So, for example, when you have the visualization of your network, you can change online the state of the link, so fail a link and recompute the routes and see where the traffic would pass between two nodes after the failure. You can also change an IGP weight. So, here, for example, I can change the IGP weight of the link between Frankfurt and Vienna, and see that my path is not changed. So it was previously going here, and now I lowered the IGP weight and the path is changed. So these are very simple examples. Regarding the BGP data, you can of course access all the computed BGP routes with all their parameters inside the tool. So that's for the init tool. So you can also get some statistics of routing table contents and so on. So now let's move to one case study. The idea of the case study was to see, well, what if I add a new peer rank to my network? So I want to large scale experiment based on Magellan. So this experiment is quite old. It's already 4 years old, but this data I can show you quickly. So it's based on Magellan. And at that time, so 4 years ago, there were only 150,000 different BGB prefixes in the BGB routing tables. And in terms of the number of different paths, it was around 650,000 routes. We also have access to NetFlow Parameter, which was collected on all the external interfaces of the GLR. And we played a little bit with that. Okay, so here I will show a very summarized view of the results. And I will focus on the links Xiao has with its commercial providers. So Xiao at the time had two commercial providers. There were four peering links with one provider and two peering links with the other one. So these are the links that are shown here. And based on the tool, we computed the amount of traffic with the current configuration that was going out through each of the links. And you can observe that the distribution of the outgoing traffic on these peering links is highly skewed. So one of the links was carrying 50% of the outgoing traffic. Two of the other links were carrying around 20%. And the other three peering links were carrying almost nothing. Okay. So that's the default routing state based on the initial configuration of Xiao. And what we did, we decided to suppress some of the peering links and see how the traffic would be redistributed with the new routing. And we also we have taken a new prospective provider. So we had a full BGB routing table, and we decided to inject it at different places in Xiao to simulate the addition of a new provider. So, in the following slides, the scenarios where we will add a new peering will be named at RX. RX is the route where we added to the peering, and the scenarios where we remove existing peerings will be named Del PRX, and PRX is the peer router. So that's the summary of what we did. So in for instance, we show results where we have suppressed PR1, PR2, PR3, and PR4, and where we have added the full BGB rep of a prospective provider at these other routers. Everything is summarized on a single figure. So here, this is the distribution of the outgoing traffic on the six links with the provider of Xiao in the default situation. So that's the distribution I showed you a few slides ago. And the other columns are just the same kind of distribution, but for the different scenarios. So the first four one here are the ones where we have removed a peering. So what we see here, if we remove the peering with the provider PR2, well, with one of the router of this provider, we see that a large fraction of the traffic that was previously carried by PR2 is now going through the pink one here, which is PR4. Okay, so it hasn't improved the distribution of the traffic on my peering links, but all the traffic going out through PR2 is now going out through PR4. Okay, so that might be surprising.
fill out, but you can predict some interesting things. And we are not trying to evolve our tool from a research-oriented tool to a more operator-oriented tool. So I would be very interested in your feedback. What kind of experiments you would expect from a BGP tool? And if that kind of experiments is interesting for you as a network operators. That's why I'm here at Tribe. I'm very interested by your feedback. So if you have any question, that would be good. Thank you very much.
Anyone have questions for? There's something like that. It's very nice to order what happens if something happens to your outgoing traffic. Are you also wondering what might happen to your incoming traffic? Because it is very nice if you become the provider for like, for instance. But
yeah,
you most of your incoming traffic is incoming. What happens? Can you do something with this?
That's the question that we usually get. Yeah, of course. Most of our students here focused on the outgoing traffic, of course, it's the easiest part. If you want to get an idea of what happens on your incoming traffic, then you have to also build a model of what's outside your network. That's still a big challenge. So you can inject into the model some AS level topologies. So there are some that require actors that you will also always have inaccuracies in these topologies regarding the kind of business relationships you have between ASs and so on. But yes, I guess it's possible to do something, but the accuracy would probably not be very good unless we have a more accurate model of the whole internet. But if you have a small set of ASs for which, for example, all the ASs on your interconnection point, you could already play with a model of all these ASs if you are eager to cooperate and give some parts of their configuration. But of course, it's easy to get.
I'd like to first of all, it looks very interesting, but questions. First, do you understand internal topologies which are utilizing AWS traffic engineering? And second question.
I'm sorry, I thought you didn't hear it well.
Do you like the parser can parse internal number of topologies utilizing not just IGP but MPLS?
No, actually we only focus on IGP. So what's BFNIS, I guess?
Thomas mentioned that you can parse routing policies.
Yes, part of routing policies, but it's still also an ongoing work. So we parse some part of the configuration, we can parse them.
So can you parse complicated routing policies?
Not too complicated routing policies, but...
And your models, are they taking into account differences in terms of implementation of different versions of software?
No, at the moment we have only a common implementation, so you can change the behavior between the nodes, the BGP implementation on different nodes in the model.
So, for example, BGP best pass selection on Cisco and Juniper is different, even if you're not using any configuration parameters. Are you planning to implement some fixes to the model where we can identify behavior of BGP best pass selection of node? Specific for the software version and this type of configuration.
Yeah, we could if there is a need for it, but until now we have been working with the query that we're quite homogeneous and we have no need for this. Of course, we cannot support with our limited resources all the different implementations of BGP.
Thank you.
Yes. That answers your question.
Yes.
If there are no more questions, then I think that concludes
allocation policies, and some of them have potential to interfere, to have an impact on the routing tables. So, because these two things seem to be very well tied together, there will be a session tomorrow, the plenary session, that the closing plenary in the first half hour, so right after the coffee break in the morning, where we will be talking about how the two things interact together, and trying to get some work done on that respect, and input from you all, so be there for that discussion. That's all, unless anyone has any other business. No? Thank you for coming, and for once we finish on time.